It gives me enormous pleasure to open this wonderful meeting with the first session, which is an area that's very close to my heart, namely the genesis of the embryo. And our first speaker in this session is Alexander Bruce from the University of South Bohemia in the Czech Republic, who one time worked in Cambridge, so he's not a foreigner here, and he's going to tell us about generating different genetic expression patterns.
Alex. Thank you. So despite what Richard just said, I hope you can hear me at the back. Today, in keeping with the remit that Martin outlined, I hope to sort of, in rather broad brushstrokes, cover this topic about how is it that during early embryogenesis in pre-implantation period do we generate different genetic expression patterns which are required for the derivation of the three lineages. But just before I do go on, I'd like to thank the organising committee for inviting me to give this talk today. I consider it a great honour to speak at a meeting that's a celebration and recognition of the work of a remarkable and such a forward-thinking man. And also, there can't be many other people in the world who are responsible through their work for bringing incalculable amounts of joy into this world. So I think that's quite a remarkable thing. And I would like to draw your attention to this article written by Martin Johnson about Bob Edwards' work and the lead up to the development of IVF. I can thoroughly recommend it. So here is a brief overview about what I'm going to talk about today. I've put it as three bullet points, but I don't intend to sort of follow it exactly in this order. It might be these points come and go as I progress through the talk. But it'll start just with a very brief introduction to the cell lineages of the mouse blastocyst and the transcription factors that are involved in deriving the genetic expression patterns which are required in the derivation of these lineages. Then I will go on and use an example of relatively recent data in which we can now begin to understand how the initiation of differential expression of transcription factors between the developing lineages occurs, which is something which has been somewhat of a black box and a little bit controversial at times. And I would like to argue for the fact that this period of development, as we all know, is highly regulative and robust, but sometimes that's as far as we get as a field, and I'd like to try and sort of stimulate some discussion about what regulative development actually means and what's the origin of it. So here is a classic introductory slide of early mouse embryo development. Start on one side here, from the oocyte will be fertilized through to the generation of a late blastocyst structure that will hatch and want to implant. And this period is about 4.5 days of development. And during this time, there are a series of cleavage divisions, of course, doubling the amount of cells in the embryo. But it's obviously more involved than that, in that, of course, by the time we get to the late blastocyst stage, we have three distinct cell lineages that have already emerged, or perhaps more presciently, because this isn't an endpoint in development, they are emerging. So we have in the blastocyst structure, an outer epithelium of a differentiating cell lineage of trophectoderm. And here, lining the surface of the cell, of the inner cell mass in contact with the blastocoel, we have a second differentiating lineage in primitive endoderm. And deep within the inner cell mass, we have the pluripotent epiblast from which the fetus will be derived later on in development. And as I say, we have the emergence of these three lineages. And classically, we sort of impose upon this period of development that the derivation of these lineages happens in two steps, whereby here at the 8 to 16 and 16 to 32 cell stages, we start to spatially segregate cells within the embryo, where we have cells that will reside on the outside and be progenitors for Trof ectoderm, whereas cells that are completely encapsulated within the embryo are the founders of the inner cell mass. And this separation of inner cell mass from the progenitors of Trof ectoderm is what we refer to as the first cell fate decision, whereas the second cell fate decision is the separation of primitive endoderm and epiblast in the ICM. And as I say, this is how we classically think about it, and I hope that sort of towards the end of the talk that I think this is somewhat of a false way of thinking about the two things separately, and actually what we have is a sort of interdependency of the derivation of these three lineages, and it's a continuum rather than two separate events. So the establishment of the three lineages is dependent upon these cells within those lineages being able to execute appropriate gene expression programs that they require in order to perform their functions. And this slide summarizes just a huge amount of work that's been done over the years, which describes the importance of transcription factors, proteins which bind to specific DNA sequences in the gene control regions of specific genes, and that are required to lead to the derivation of these three lineages. So, for example, it's known that the transcription factor TEAD4 acting through CDX2 and to an extent GATA3 is important for derivation of the Trof ectoderm, and I'll return to that later. But also, there are other transcription factors which are important, such as NANOG and OCT4, etc., in derivation of the inner cell mass. There is mutual antagonism, where these transcription factors can repress each other's expression, thereby delineating more distinctly these two lineages as they arise. And similarly, within the ICM, when we delineate epiblast from PE, we have transcription factors which are responsible for this, which also act in mutually antagonistic ways. So transcription factors, and by default, the different gene expression patterns they regulate and control are the central players in establishing the lineages of the blastocyst. But I tend to think about them as being somewhat of the effectors. So here we just have a sort of by analogy, if this is a process by which a cell is going to decide its cell fate from A to Z, then the establishment of the crucial genetic expression of transcription factors which are required to derive that lineage, I would argue, are occupying this sort of territory somewhere towards the end, and then there'll be gene expression patterns which are responsible for the function. And the bit that I think is sort of lacking a little bit in our knowledge is all this part in the earlier part of the alphabet, where we don't really know satisfactorily, I would argue, what is responsible for initiating the correct transcription factor expression at the correct time, in the correct cell lineage, in a way that will be appropriate for driving gene expression for correct blastocyst development. And I think one of the reasons why here we have a wealth of information and here a sort of relative dearth is because, as I alluded to earlier, the early the pre-implantation stages of mammalian development and mouse embryo development are highly regulative. But I'd just like to take a couple of slides to really sort of try and encourage us to think what does that mean? We read it in our textbooks and in the introductions to the papers that we read. But what does it really mean? So here is just a simple explanation of an example of regulation where we might have a two-cell stage embryo that we've extracted and having culture that can culture to a blastocyst. We could transfer it back to a foster mother and generate a viable mouse. Similarly, We could do the same thing and deliberately ablate one of these two blastomeres and still have the same outcome. So the embryo is able somehow to sense this change and adapt in a way which still has a successful outcome. And of course, this is what in the clinic we try to, this regulative property we try to exploit in terms of biopsying cells for PGD, for example. Similarly, if we consider a cross between embryos derived from mice of different coat colour and make a chimera, the developmental programme is still able to adapt to this and rescue, then this is something that we can exploit in terms of generating transgenic mice with injections of bona fide ES cells. So the development is robust and flexible and able to respond to any interventions we make. And as experimental scientists, that's what we're trying to do all the time. We're trying to make a perturbation and, relative to a control, ask, does it reject or confirm our hypothesis? But we're having to do this in our field against this highly regulative landscape. And I think it represents somewhat of an elephant in the room type scenario. And I'm not quite sure what the answer is, but I think that we really need to try and improve our incorporation of regulative developmental context into the interpretation of our data. And as I say, that our experiments really need to be more considered against this this regulative backdrop. And I put these examples here of other classical models of development which follow more deterministic paths of mechanistic paths. And in some respects, I think that our thinking is a little bit blinkered when we consider these things, because what's good for the goose here is not necessarily good for the gander in terms of the mammalian embryo. So, anyway, I just wanted to introduce that concept about regulation. So what about how, what do we know about how different transcription factor gene expression patterns are derived in the embryo? Well, clearly the classical starting point is here at the third and fourth cleavages, where we generate spatially distinct cells. We know from the works of pioneering embryologists that if we move cells around between a relative in and outer position, we can change their fate. Basically, what this this third and fourth cleavage, the generation of inner and outer cells in the embryo, does for us is it derives two distinct environmental niches in which differential gene expression programs can be hosted and lead to different outcomes in terms of differentiation. And it's only really within the last four or so years that from knowing these concepts from an embryological concept to getting to some mechanistic standpoint, the mechanisms which are involved, it's only relatively recently. And I asked you to remember in one of the introductory slides this transcription factor TEAD4, which can activate the expression of CDX2 to promote outer cells to adopt a trophectoderm cell fate. But one of the problems when we look at the expression of TEAD4 in the embryo between inner and outer cells is that TEAD4 is expressed in inner and outer cells equally. So how is it that the regulatory output of the TEAD4 transcription factor is restricted to outer cells and inhibited in inner cells? And work from Sasaki's lab showed that it's actually regulated by a pathway known as the hipposignaling pathway, which is able to sense cell-cell contact. So here in the inner cell, which is completely encapsulated within the embryo, signaling through this hippo pathway is able to activate a kinase called LATS, which in turn phosphorylates a protein called YAP and prevents it from going into the nucleus. It sequesters it into the cytoplasm. Now, YAP is an essential co-activator for TEAD4. So despite the presence of TEAD4 being in this inner cell nucleus, it's denuded of any regulatory function because it doesn't have its partner YAP. Therefore, we have no CDX2 expression in inner cells. Whereas in outer cells, and it's not entirely sure exactly the mechanism, maybe there's a deficiency of Hippo signaling because there's an exposed apical domain here, or perhaps polarity proteins which are localized within this apical domain directly inhibit Hippo signaling. But what happens is we have YAP is not phosphorylated by LATS. It can enter the nucleus, and TEAD4 can then activate CDX2 expression. And this is probably really the first of mechanistic insight about how we can generate different transcription factor expression patterns between differentiated or developing cell lineages in the mouse embryo. And indeed, once this expression has been set up differentially, then autoregulatory feedback loops, CDX2 feeding back on its own expression, and these mutually antagonistic transcriptional regulations I talked about can reinforce these identities and these gene expression patterns. But that's not the whole story. So, for example, it's also been shown that in the 8-cell embryo and outer cells of the 16-cell stage embryo, this is an in situ for CDX2 messenger RNA from a paper of 2008, that the CDX2 messenger RNA can be apically localized in the outer cells. And if one imagines a situation whereby a cell divides to give two trophectoderm progenitors, two outside cells, they would clearly both inherit this CDX2, but the converse is true if it divides to generate an inner ICM founder cell and an outer trophectoderm progenitor. It will only be the outer cell that will go on to be have a trophectoderm cell fate that will inherit this CDX2 messenger RNA. And this sort of brings me back to my theme about regulation, because what is regulation at its most base level? I will argue it's more than one way to get to an outcome. It's a way of getting from A to B, but by various different paths. And clearly, we can see here by the combination of Hippo signaling, differential Hippo signaling between inner and outer cells, and the differential inheritance of CDX2 messenger RNA, we have a sort of a point at which we might be able to understand regulation and how it's happening in the embryo. One other thing that I think is worth mentioning is that this differential inheritance between different cells of cell fate messenger RNAs is something which crops up in more simpler organisms of more deterministic development. And here we have a Drosophila oocyte. I think this is Oscar localized to one side of the oocyte. And I don't really have a problem that we might see the same thing in mammalian embryos, because if we consider these two species evolving from a common ancestor, I don't think it's beyond the realms of possibility that this type of mechanism can be retained in mammalian development. Another question that I'd like to address is, as I said, the inner cells are derived from two rounds of division at the 8 to 16 and 16 to 32 cell stage, either by these differentiative asymmetric divisions which generate an outer and an inner cell, or in contrast to these conservative or symmetric divisions which generate two outside cells. But it's two consecutive waves of division, and we are generating ICM founders. But the question is, are these ICM founders all equivalent, irrespective if they came from this first wave or this second wave of asymmetric division? Because they're all progenitors for either the epiblast or the primitive endoderm later on in development. So the question is, are ICM founders coming from this second wave of cell internalization distinct from those coming from this first wave? And I'm aware that there are contradictory views in the literature about this. But my personal view is that I favour what comes from this study that suggests actually this might be the case where non-invasive cell lineage tracing, just looking at how cells are allocated during normal development, from this paper of Morris et al., suggests that in this first wave, the cells that are internalized are very strongly biased to become epiblast, whereas those that come in this second 16 to 32 cell stage are more likely, more strongly biased to become primitive endoderm. And if we consider this situation here, where we're just talking about the importance of cell-cell contact and hipposignaling in what we might call the first cell fate decision, I don't think this is too much of an unreasonable mechanism to believe, because cells which are coming in this 16 to 32 cell stage transition, the progenitors that have been on the outside have been there for 12 hours, a whole cell cycle of 12 hours where they've been exposed to this type of regulation, distancing them further and further from the pluripotent state, whereas those that have been internalized in the first wave are somehow protected, and I don't think it's so surprising that they might more preferentially contribute to epiblastin, whereas those coming in the second wave would more be biased to contribute towards primitive endoderm. And really what this means is that you have a situation whereby it's not two distinct cell fate decisions that are happening, but a continuum. The two cell fate decisions are somewhat interlinked with one another. And as one of the 20th century's lesser known and more frustrated embryologists might have put it, I think that everything has to be considered as being connected with everything else. But the importance relative position of cells within the embryo is an obvious start point. But here we have 8 cell stage embryo. All the blastomeres are spatially equivalent. They have contact with other blastomeres and exposed apical domains. We know that if we disaggregate these embryos and put them with host embryos, that these blastomeres can contribute to all the cell lineages. But does spatial equivalence and pluripotency really equate under normal non-perturbed development that these cells are functionally equivalent? And I don't think that they are. And this is a rather busy slide, but it's a very elegant paper from last year in which they measured the nuclear kinetics of transcription factor OCT4, which is important for maintaining pluripotency in inner cells. And they fused to this OCT4 GFP, but a GFP which is only fluoresces when you shine light on it. It's photoactivatable. So at the 8 cell stage, they can isolate a blastomere's nucleus, activate the GFP from OCT4, we can see here, and then measure over time how quickly that signal is diffused out of the nucleus. And what they found was that there are two different types of diffusion kinetics. Some cells retained a high immobile fraction of the OCT4, whereas some of them got rid of it quite rapidly. And if they then spooled on in development, what this was found to show was that those cells that retained this high immobile fraction virtually invariably undergone an asymmetric division that generated an ICM founder, which of course you would expect OCT4 to be able to do that. Whereas those which rapidly lose the OCT4, or there's a big flux of OCT4 from their nucleus, generated a symmetric division in two troephectoderm cells. So the differences in the nuclear retention of OCT4 at the 8 cell stage, which is before any spatial identity has been conferred on the embryo, is informative of subsequent cell fate of the daughter cell progeny. And I think that's a really remarkable result, one of the most important results to my mind in the recent years. But what is the origin of this early interblastomere heterogeneity, this before the onset of spatial identity? Well, here again, we have our little scheme of pre-implantation development in mouse. And to the 8 cell stage, we're talking somewhere in the region of 3 days. But 3 days to generate 8 cells, it seems rather generous when you consider other organisms such as the frog during the same time, who effectively have tadpoles swimming around. So one of the questions I think one has to ask is, why are these cell cycles before the emergence of a spatial identity, why are they so long? And I think it's an appealing hypothesis, although very difficult to prove, that what is perhaps happening here is that basal levels of transcription, so in these blastomeres, the idea is that there's a basal amount of transcription happening, and it sort of fluctuates up and down. But given enough time, this can self-organize itself in terms of generating these early asymmetries, which seem to be associated with ultimate cell fate. And this is what's sometimes referred to as a stochastic model. And I think that perhaps the length of these cell cycles is a good sort of circumstantial evidence for this type of model. But again, it's not necessarily the whole story, because we know that at the two-cell stage, these blastomeres can divide in one of two ways, either along their meridian or along their equator, generating these three different subtypes of four-cell stage embryo. And more often than not, we see this arrangement that seems to be more developmentally competent when we transfer back to foster mothers. Also, within this class of embryos, we know from detailed cell lineage studies that there's a degree of predictable cell fate in terms of blastocyst patterning that we can predict from these type of embryos, which we can't from this. And moreover, that they exhibit inter-cell molecular differences, such as epigenetic differences that Marielena might refer to later. So this invites the question that, is there some kind of intrinsic property of the embryo which is able to bias development of particular blastomeres towards particular cell lineages? And this, again, we know is a sort of hot topic and perhaps a little controversial, and we can cite experiments in which we try to negate such ideas of patterning in the oocyte, for example, by spinning oocytes to disrupt the cytoplasm or and homogenize any cell patterning that might be there, and we still get development, or we can remove the poles of oocytes and still get development. But I would argue that is the lack of an essential phenotype, so these things might not be essential because we can disrupt them and still get successful development, but is a lack of an essential phenotype, essential role rather, the same as having no role at all in the normal development? And I think that's a really crucial definition, because under normal circumstances, all these experimental perturbations that we do to try and understand aren't happening. I don't see any reason why the stochastic model or this probabilistic model can't exist side by side. So just to sum up, as I said, I don't think that there are any reasons why stochastic and probabilistic mechanisms of generating early intercell heterogeneity prior to the emergence of spatial identity, I don't see why there's any reason why they can't coexist, and I think it's somewhat of a sort of futile argument in our field sometimes, because each mechanism has the potential to feed into generating the necessary and transcription factor-led differential gene expression programs that are required to derive the free blastocyst lineages. And moreover, as returning to my theme about regulation, I would also argue that the coexistence of these type of these two types of models could actually contribute to the remarkable regulative properties of the developing mouse embryo. So I just will end there. Although I didn't show any primary data from the lab today, I would like to acknowledge the University of South Bohemia that hosts me in the beautiful city of České Budějovice. My funding from Marie Curie and the Czech Ministry of Education, and our remarkable model system that keeps us all so entertained. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Alexander. Can I just ask, when you talk about something special, the slow pace of development.
Mm-hmm.
In my naivety, I've just assumed it's dictated by the fact that the, with viviparity, the reproductive tract has to change from a condition conducive to sperm transport to one facilitating implantation, takes a lot of time necessarily, so that this is a response to that rather than anything more.
I could certainly agree with that, but I would say that doesn't exclude the fact that the two things co-evolve together. So that might be a reason why it has to happen, but because that's happening, we also provide a window of opportunity during which stochastic mechanisms can operate, where they wouldn't necessarily operate in other models of development which don't have that time window. So, in essence, I agree with you. I think the two things could co-evolve together quite nicely.
Questions from the audience? At the back there, Jonathan.
How do the maternal effect genes fit into this model? The maternal effect genes fit into this model, especially with evidence that some of them are spatially localized in the cortex and asymmetrically distributed?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no. Just take a moment to consider your question. I would spin it on its head a little, I would say, and say, what is it about maternal effect genes that wouldn't fit into the model? Because in the end of the day, the two things could, in the normal development, still be pushing towards the same outcome. So why would it matter? Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I would argue that some experiments which have been designed to test that have showed that they're not necessarily essential. So there are other mechanisms which can compensate and still get to the same outcome. But I don't think I understand quite your question. Why there would be a problem there? Why they can't both, under normal circumstances, pull in the same direction? And I would argue that actually the fact that that's probably what they are doing. They're pulling in the same direction, and it's only under the extraordinary circumstances whereby we perturb one or the other that we're able to see the effect. I don't know if that satisfies you, but I would like to speak to you about it more after the session.
Coming back to Richard Gardner's point about the slow development, another way of looking at this question is endocrinological, and that is that it's necessary for the embryo to be implanted a few days later, and during this time the corpus luteum has to develop progesterone, and in the mouse estrogen is very important, and so maybe the development has to be slow. Mm-hmm. In order for that timing to occur.
Yes, I think that's a perfectly perfectly valid point, and at risk of repeating my response to Richard, that could be the reason, and therefore provide the mechanism whereby stochastic gene expression can contribute to successful development. I mean, we know in simple organisms where development is, we don't have these complications that you and Richard have just spoke about. You know, things can happen very rapidly and do happen very rapidly. Okay, so if we imagine that these are the breaks, why they have to go slowly, it to my mind, provides a window of opportunity where new regulatory mechanisms can evolve. And by having that window of opportunity to evolve new mechanisms of gene control, in addition to whatever might have been there before, however vestigial, you contribute to the robustness and regulative development. So I agree entirely with both of your ideas. I just think it provides the window in which stochastic mechanisms can operate.
Particularly with respect to translation into human work, Do you see in mouse any differential cell survival at these early stages? I understand that in normal mouse development, all the cells basically survive and are tracking off into different differential pathways. But in humans, one's used to the idea that there's quite a lot of differential cell survival in the sense that you set up some variation and the ones that are not working properly just die off and you adjust in that way.
I mean, I would bow to your knowledge in terms of what happened in human embryos.
I'm just a jobbing clinical geneticist. I don't know the detail.
But there is differential survival. So there is in the inner cell mass what appears to be regulated apoptotic cell death. Whether that's as a consequence of cells that haven't sorted themselves out into one lineage or another in time or not, I think is open to question. To answer your basic question, then that's an example where there is differential cell survival. But I don't know, and there's probably people who've studied it in much more detail than I have that could give you a better answer, but I'm not quite sure anybody knows why that is. It's just an observation.
I liked your talk very much, and I think it's full of sense. You alluded to the different early cleavage patterns in early mouse development, and you said some are more frequent than others, and some are more compatible with development than others. Now, clearly, this is quite important in the human context if the same applies there, and you're doing PGD, because you don't want to take the wrong blastomeres. And I wonder whether there was any evidence from your work that PGD could be more successful on some sorts of types of cleavage pattern than others?
No evidence from work that we've done ourselves, but my feeling, you know, from reading other people's work and that, is that you raise a good point, but I think that at least at this early stage, pre-compaction or whatever, the embryo is pretty robust enough to respond and sort itself out again. But that's just based on sort of instinctive, you know, informed knowledge. So maybe, but my feeling is I think if you do it early enough, probably it won't matter. But I'm not well informed enough in terms of human embryology.
Another question here.
Thank you. My name is Dalit from Tel Aviv, Israel. Thank you for the interesting lecture. We have a human embryo regarding the involvement of CDX2 in trophoblast differentiation. We have a human embryonic stem cell line that have derived from unbalanced translocation embryo. And it's interesting to see that the trophoblast differentiation in these human embryonic stem cells fails. We don't see beta HCG secretion, and at the same time, we don't see the expression of CDX2 as compared to the wild-type human embryonic stem cells that express the CDX2 and secrete the beta HCG when you differentiate them into trophoblasts. So I think it's a very nice, as regards to your lecture, to show that CDX2 is really involved in trophoblast differentiation. And the reason for implantation failure in the translocation carriers is actually the misexpression of the CDX2 and in correlation the inefficiency to secrete beta HCG.
I guess I would agree with what you said.
It may be interesting to see how the CDX2 is expressed within the different cells in the 8-cell stage embryo, as Martin said before, for PGD, I think.
Yes. Yeah. No, I agree, I guess. I'm not quite sure how what your question is. I just agree with your statement.
No, it was a comment, not a question.
Thank you.